And I think this is another moment where we can come together and confront the extraction of resources from our rural communities and sort of make the demand that transnational corporations who are making lots of profit off our rural community members and rural resources, that they put back into the community at least as much as they're taking out.
Welcome to the 368th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. During the recent Western Minnesota Food Forum the Land Stewardship Project held at the University of Minnesota Morris, there was a lot of discussion about how we can build community-based food systems that pay farmers a fair price for raising a healthy product while benefiting local Main Street economies. But let's be honest, there's a major elephant in the room whenever folks get together to discuss remaking the farm and food system in rural America. Unprecedented consolidation in everything from farming and meat processing to grain handling and the grocery business has drained our rural communities of wealth and created a situation where they are often at the mercy of big ag and big food. As a result, farmers are not allowed fair access to markets. Local businesses such as grocery stores and meat lockers are going under, and making a living wage is next to impossible. And once local economic activity is consolidated in the hands of a few, it just isn't businesses and people who disappear. Institutions such as schools and churches also close shop. In such an environment, developing an infrastructure for processing and distributing locally produced food must go hand in hand with fighting consolidation, antitrust violations, and market manipulation. We must also take steps to support the people most harmed by a corporate-controlled, industrialized system. That includes farmers, but it also includes folks who work day-to-day in CAFOs and processing plants. This latter group often includes people who immigrated here in search of a better life. That's why it was fitting that one of the breakout sessions during the Western Minnesota Food Forum was titled Big Ag and Welcoming Rural Communities. Led by Christina Ortiz, an associate professor of cultural anthropology at the University of Minnesota Morris, the session gave farmers and others a chance to share stories about the negative impacts of a large-scale industrialized food and farming system, and ways people can work together to create more welcoming and inclusive communities. The university campus in Morris is an interesting place for such a discussion to take place. The town of Morris is in the middle of farm country, and from 1887 to 1909, the current campus of UMM was an American Indian boarding school. This school represents a particularly dark time in American history. 16 mission and federally operated American Indian boarding schools in Minnesota and hundreds across the country separated children from their families and attempted to eliminate native languages and cultures, with intergenerational impacts still felt across Indian country. In 1910, the University of Minnesota established the West Central School of Agriculture on the site of the former Indian boarding school. The Ag School educated area high school students in a boarding school environment until 1963. The university itself was founded in 1960. That's all to say that whenever we discuss the impacts of a certain use of the land on people and communities, we must also take a region's history into consideration. After the Western Minnesota Food Forum, I chatted with Christine Ortiz about why an industrialized approach to agriculture is so extractive, how it lends itself to vilification of certain groups of people, and why she feels hopeful that people in rural spaces can come together to not only make big ag and big food pay their fair share, but to move forward and create something better. So Nina, we were today here at the Western Minnesota Food Forum, and we talked a lot about things like what you would talk about at a food forum. You know, where are we going to get the food? How are we going to distribute it? Certain models? What are some of the barriers? Make sure farmers get paid fairly? But one of the things, we had a breakout session that you led where we talked about, and I think this is just as key as any of these other pieces, the impact. We talked about the impact that big ag has on rural communities, and I know this is something that you have studied and looked at a little bit. There's a lot of people who say, well, big ag does have this impact. It almost seems like people maybe notice
the diminishment of communities, but they don't really have a grasp on this is what impact it's really having. And I think you are in a really interesting position as somebody who studies anthropology, and you're in a community. This has a long history. This is a very rural community that this college is in. This college used to be, as I said, the Indian school, and then it was the West Central Agricultural School. So that's a really interesting place to be, I think, and for someone who's looking at this kind of thing, I'm really interested in your insights on kind of that big question, how is big ag affecting rural communities?
So from my perspective, industrial ag, we should think about it as an extractive industry, especially when we think about rural communities. They're not just, it's not just unsustainable ecologically, it's also unsustainable socially, right? So when you don't pay or aren't able, right, to pay workers fair wages, then their lives are less healthy. They're not able to access healthcare. We have a lack of rural healthcare to start with. When things consolidate and go to the bigger towns, then rural folks who do live here and work here can't get access to healthcare that is affordable and near to them. And so the consolidation and the primacy of profit for big agricultural companies and industrial ag at a transnational scale means that they're just sucking out so much of the good stuff that exists in rural communities, and not just the profits themselves, but also the health and well-being of rural community members who just really want to make their lives in these communities and raise their children and have, you know, nice things.
Yeah, one of the examples you brought up was Perry, Iowa, and a packing plant, yeah, and how they kind of held that community hostage. I thought that was a really interesting thing of them getting away with not only not paying their way, but then really just leaving that community high and dry.
Absolutely. So Deb Fink is a researcher who wrote a book about meatpacking in Perry, Iowa. And even though that was in like the late 90s, all of that remained true up until very recently when the packing plant closed. Mm-hmm. And basically, the packing plant came to the community because the community gave them a tax abatement. And then essentially, every time it came time to renegotiate that, they said, well, if you don't give us the tax abatement, or if you don't renew these benefits again, we're going to leave the community. And then eventually, they decided that it was too expensive to retrofit the plant to keep up with their current model of processing and closed the plant anyway. And so throughout the decades, the community lost a bunch of that revenue that was just extracted from the community. And at that time, right, a lot of those workers were Spanish-speaking, Latinx immigrants, immigrants from Asia, and that company didn't take really any responsibility for providing things like bilingual staff at the school, supporting culturally appropriate education for immigrant families, helping immigrant families find affordable housing or become homeowners. The packing plants divested from all the investments they had in that community, and then, like you said, left the community high and dry when they closed the plant. And that's just, you know, that is not a unique story to Perry. Yeah. And it is the model that many industrial transnational food corporations work on. And it's a shame, I think.
Well, and people maybe are, if they're aware of this at all, maybe they're aware of how these companies can externalize their environmental costs and place them upon society so the public has to pay. This is an example of, I guess, the social impacts being externalized.
Absolutely right. Yep. And I think as community members, too, one of the things we were talking about this afternoon is if individual rural communities are negotiating with these packing plants, they're really at a disadvantage, right? The transnational companies have big lawyers and lots of money to lobby and make policies that are advantageous to them. And an individual rural community doesn't really have any of that leverage to work with. But if we think about rural community members across the nation even, but especially in the rural Midwest, if we work together and think about our shared values and our shared needs, we can work together to negotiate with those transnational companies and have a bit more leverage when we do work together.
Yeah, you had talked a little bit about this idea of people kind of in the community getting together, and I'm trying to think of the word you use, but kind of
solidarity,
yeah, which is an old term, but it's, boy, is it fitting now, getting together and really seeing this as something that they need to really do reach across the divide, whatever political leanings or whatever, that this is a threat, a common threat to their community.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we can think back to the farm crisis of the 1980s. We have a long tradition in many parts of the Midwest of having solidarity as community members. I think about, you know, in the olden days, right, penny auctions and making sure that, you know, somebody's farm didn't get repossessed. And we came together and showed the power of community when we supported each other like that. And I think this is another moment where we can come together and confront the extraction of resources from our rural communities and sort of make the demand that transnational corporations who are making lots of profit off our rural community members and rural resources, that they put back into the community at least as much as they're taking out.
Have we lost that a little bit? I mean, it seems like it's really... I remember the 80s. I'm a child of the 80s, and I'm not farming because I graduated in 1980, and there was no place for me on the farm because of the farm crisis. Have we lost that a little bit, or how positive do you feel that we can kind of get that solidarity back a little bit?
I feel really hopeful, and I feel really hopeful in part because for me, this is not just a decades-long sort of thing. When I think about community and strength and wellness and well-being, I think all the way back to indigenous concepts of community and taking care of the land and being a good relative to the land and the animals that live on it and how we can sustainably make our lives together. And I think if we can return to some of those principles and think about ourselves more as in solidarity and in community and responsible to and for one another, rather than focusing on, you know, this is my business or my farm and my family and I need to get ahead. If we can think about how we can all help each other be better and well, then that gives me a lot of hope. And I don't think that's something that human people ever lose. But I think that oftentimes the lure of individualism and capitalism has gotten sort of elevated more than it is healthy for us.
Well, another situation that we're in is the idea of the other, that big ag has really benefited, big corporations have really benefited from making immigrants an enemy that the folks in the community should be looking at instead of the corporation kind of thing. Isn't that kind of the situation that we're in a little bit?
Absolutely. And again, that's a thing that keeps coming around century after century after century, right? Is the vilification of an other and the blaming of an other for whatever ills society is facing at the moment. And right now it tends to be Latin American, Latinx immigrants, and especially laborers in the industrial food chain. And I think it's really important that we remember that the bad guy is the one who's taking all the money and resources from our community, and not the immigrant who is in our community trying to make a life and trying to raise their kids, and who, by the way, part of the reason that they are coming here is because our transnational, international policies made it impossible for them to live comfortably and healthily where they are from. And if we don't take responsibility for that, that is also a crime against justice, frankly.
I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about history. We touched on a little bit with the 1980s and that kind of thing, but was there a time in the work that you've done where you saw that really big ag, it's always had this... Big corporations have always had this power, you know, going to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and everything else. But was there a time when we really there was a turning point in agriculture where we're like, oh boy, they have much more power than we can control right now, or in the communities that really were at their bidding, kind of that kind of situation?
That's such a great question. And I'll be honest, I don't totally have a great answer for it. But some of the work that I do also looks at company towns as an older model of how power and control are used to extract resources from rural communities and marginalized people, right? So one of the examples is Buxton, Iowa, which was a primarily black community, a mining town, did really well. They had a whole like middle and upper class at some point of like black intellectuals, and then the mine closed and the community literally disappeared off the map and no longer exists at all because mining in that product went bust, right? today we don't have company towns anymore, but transnational food corporations do continue to exert the same types of power and control over, or attempt to, over employees and rural communities for the same purposes, to extract resources and money. And while there was, for me, there is no like great heyday of like everything was idyllic and wonderful, but I do think there are great examples, again, of indigenous communities and situations in which people are really trying to support one another and resist that extractive force, for sure.
The breakout session that we had earlier where you were talking to some folks, I was just really struck at how people really care about the community and they're really looking for some ideas out there. And we were talking about food hubs and we were talking about ways of making opportunities for beginning farmers and making these places safe places for people who maybe we don't normally associate with Midwestern agriculture, that kind of thing. One of the things you brought up that I had never heard about before, and I was wondering if you could talk more, is this idea of creating a third space?
Yeah.
A third space. What is a third space? It's not upstairs. It's not up in the sky. It's right here in our communities, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the idea of a third space is a community space that is sort of unaffiliated with some existing faction and which you don't need money to participate in, right? So a lot of community places where people gather are like maybe coffee shops or restaurants, which are great and fabulous, but if you don't have the money to sort of buy your presence in that space, it becomes really hard to participate in those spaces. Or alternatively, a lot of community spaces are like church affiliated. Well, if you don't share that religious view or if that church space is not really welcoming to you, and again, I'm thinking it's in particular of some of our queer community members, right? Then that's not really a welcoming or available space for you. So third spaces are these spaces like community centers, libraries, right? These kind of public goods where you can go. And I think in the rural Midwest, I always say also all season, right? Because we do have some really great outdoor spaces, but you can't gather year round in those spaces, right? And so third spaces, particularly libraries, right, are so important. And having that function of like being able to bring all different kinds of people together and be accessible to all different kinds of people is really key for making solidarity and community and feeling like one belongs in a place.
And we're losing those, right?
Yeah. Well, we just don't have a lot of them, right? In many cases, we never had them, but it wasn't a big deal because some communities were so homogenous, right? Every person in, you know, random little rural place was Lutheran, and so gathering at the Lutheran church was not a barrier, right? But today, in a globalized world where even rural communities are very globalized, right, it is, and much more diverse, and we would like them to be diverse, right? Mm-hmm. It makes it more important for us to think about how are we lowering the barriers to belonging and making community for sure.
It sounds like maybe one of the ways to create those third spaces is having the resources to create them. That's the public money for public goods kind of idea. But in order to have that public money, it sounds like we have to make big ag and big corporations pay their own way. I mean, that's something that we talked about a little bit in this meeting was, making them, you know, you had the example of Perry, Iowa, where they weren't paying their way and left the town high and dry. But just even if they are going to stay in the community, figuring out ways that they can, what are some of the ways that they can kind of pay their own way and that they aren't paying their own way right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So, for example, companies that aren't paying a living wage means that we have more users of spaces like a food shelf. We have immigrant community members, and you need specially qualified and trained educators to be able to serve those students who have particular needs, language needs, cultural needs, religious needs, etc. You have to be trained to do that, and companies are not paying into a system that supports those needs and resources. I think a lot about just how are we asking the company to make sure that everyone is well in a community, right? So when you have more workers who work very dangerous jobs, because agricultural jobs are some of the most dangerous in the United States, right? We need robust rural healthcare systems. And often we don't have like a gynecologist, and Latinx immigrants and other immigrants of color are in the prime childbearing years often when they come here to work. And if we don't have a way to help them give birth safely, or if they have to drive very far and it's very expensive, that is really a challenge for us. And companies are not helping alleviate those problems when they are, again, extracting profit and resources and not paying into the system.
As a professor here, do you have students who are reeling from the impacts of maybe growing up in that kind of a situation with kind of the takeover of some of the rural communities that they come from?
So our students are, we have a lot of students who are indigenous, who come from reservations or from urban spaces, and those communities have been dispossessed of their land, right? And with that, all the knowledge about things like foraging, hunting, collecting, and making food that are key to everyday survival. And I really think about that a lot when I think about resource extraction of knowledge and skills, right? Immigrant students, we don't have a ton of immigrant students, but we have some. And I think, again, about people like me, right? My grandfather was a Mexican-American migrant worker, worked sugar beet fields in Minnesota, among other places. He had a lot of knowledge about food preparation, tamales, butchering, all these kinds of things that I did not get because my parents and grandparents wanted the family to be upwardly mobile. And so I went to school and learned academic skills like how to answer emails. And while that's really great and I have really benefited from that, there's also a loss of both culture and language that comes with that upward mobility sometimes. And our students, I think, at Morris in particular, are deeply impacted by some of those losses, regardless of where they come from. Yeah. Because there are many of them first-generation students and low-income students who, when they come here.
I mean, one of the questions I was going to ask is just living in an area like this, you must see the impacts, not even just from the academic studies you do, but you must see the impacts just driving through these communities.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I live here, right? I'm a researcher and I do data collection and I talk to people. But one of the really important things I think about the work that I do is that I care about the community and I continue to live here and I want to live here and I want to be a part of a community that welcomes me and that I feel like I belong in. And, you know, a lot of research is also extractive, right? We go, we talk to people, we take it, we write an article that, you know, our 10 colleagues are going to read and nobody else, right? It's behind a paywall. And I just think that's unethical, right? Part of my commitment to rural communities is that the research that I do and that I do with students in particular needs to feed back into a community need or a community use because I do live here and I do want things to be good for more and all people. And research is one of the ways that we can accomplish that. And so I think a lot about I'm very critical of Big Ag, obviously, right? But also, I really care about rural communities and I'm critical because I love the place that I live and I want everybody to be able to make their life who wants to. And in order to do that, we do have to be critical of some of these systems and processes that really just are not sustainable or not really working for us.
One of the things you talked about one of the things you look at is things like at a parent-teacher's conference, how is it different for an immigrant family to go into that than, say, it may have been for a white, European-oriented family, I don't know, 40 years ago, 20, maybe even 20, 25 years ago kind of thing?
Yeah. And so this is, again, right, one of these resources that we really need to think about, right? How many rural communities lack the interpreting staff and the qualified, trained staff to be able to talk directly to a parent about their child's performance, right? So many communities don't have these resources where teachers can make those good relationships with the parents of the kids that are coming in. And then to also think, it's really easy in a rural immigrant community to think all Mexicans are laborers. And the truth is actually not that, right? We have tons of immigrant, and in particular Latinx, but also from a whole bunch of different other places, people who are working maybe labor-intensive jobs right now, but who have extraordinary qualifications that in some cases they're prohibited from using in the context of the United States. And we should recognize that there are these resources in our community and be working on ways to use them more effectively, and at the same time, not just paint everyone with the same brush and say, oh, you talk with an accent, so you must be a dairy worker, mm-hmm. right? You should not be defined by your immigrant status or your labor status, right? When we think about welcoming communities and welcoming newcomers, we really need to think beyond these, you know, very cursory impressions of people and get a little deeper. And part of that is getting to know people better, right? And part of getting to know people better is being able to communicate effectively with them, which requires some cultural and linguistic competence and training.
What really strikes me when you talk about bringing these skills to this country is how many immigrants come from rural and farming backgrounds and have some really incredible skills. And they do go to work for these big operations, and boy, a lot of them have a very negative view of agriculture in this country and say, yeah, I don't want to. But some of them, we've seen some of them come through our Farm Beginnings course more and more. In fact, we're increasingly seeing people who had those skills and really want to apply them as an entrepreneur in this country. It's really interesting to see, and it's heartbreaking when you see other people who are like, their spirit's broken when it comes to agriculture. They're like, if this is the way agriculture is in this country, I don't want anything to do with it if I have a choice.
Yeah, well, and some of the people who have this fantastic expertise, you know, I know somebody who's trained in cheese making and animal care and digital technology. Like, this is a whole array of things. Is such a talented person. But the barrier to, like, buying land and running his own farm is just extraordinary, right? And there's so many really qualified people in whole bunches of different fields. And our failure to recognize those talents and assets and to legitimize them so that they can be put to use is really tragic. And a bunch of those people who are disillusioned, in part, are disillusioned because we piloted some of these terrible technologies and processes in their own country, which you know, propelled them to come to the United States. And so, of course, that person is going to be like, oh, no, I'm tapped out. Like, this is not. But if we can support the people who want to do agriculture in a more sustainable and healthy way, in ways that are sometimes maybe consonant with their indigenous roots and heritage that they are familiar with and had to stop in their home countries, if they can use that knowledge productively here in the rural Midwest, let's help them do that instead of saying, oh no, you are only qualified to run this milk machine forever and you will never be anything but a laborer in this company. That's not great for us.
Have you seen any examples, either in this country or maybe even in other countries, where they have made big ag pay, or I don't know how a better way to say it, but held them accountable, I guess, for some of these costs, and have kind of made it so that they are not externalizing all these social environmental costs on these communities? You know of any examples out there or not?
Not really. I would say a couple of maybe promising efforts include Peru, who pulled out of some international agreements and prioritized at some point in the last like 10 or 20 years, they prioritized investing in like indigenous agroecology projects mm-hmm. rather than transnational company investments. And I think that's, you know, at least going in the right direction. I can't speak to how successful it's been at a country level, but I think that's the right attitude to have. And I think a lot of, you know, we're talking at big scale, macro scale here, transnational, right. But I think actually a lot of the effort can be right here in your own community. When we think about rural spaces, third spaces in Marshalltown, they realized in the late 90s and early 2000s that a huge part of their Mexican population that was working there was all from the same city in Mexico, Villatuato. And so they sent delegations of city council members and other civic leaders to Mexico to sort of learn about the community in order to better understand their neighbors who were there now in Iowa. And I think that kind of of learning effort and the effort to get to know people is really sort of moving in the right direction. And they really, you know, they went well beyond like a welcoming festival or something, yeah. and really took that extra effort to learn about this clear group of people who was there that would be useful to know more about. And I think that really benefited the community. It benefited the people who participated in that program. And that is one of those great ideas. And it doesn't always have to be super ginormous. Right here in Morris, Minnesota, I worked with colleagues to create a certification program for interpreters. So now kids who, when we first started the program and like ran it as a pilot, they were like in middle school. Now they're high school or graduating from high school and they can do the certification program as well. Maybe their parent did it. And now we have, you know, we can build a whole network of certified interpreter volunteers in or paid in some cases, which is even better, right? Yeah. Paid positions, right? We can validate those skills that people have and are using in the community and make sure that they are professionalized in ways that are appropriate to the jobs that are being done instead of just saying, oh, Jose speaks Spanish and English. He must be able to be an interpreter, right? Like, that is not how that works at all. Right. And so some of these really local sort of grassroots efforts can have a humongous impact for the good. And it can be overwhelming to think about these like macro systems, but we can do really important local grassroots efforts that challenge that power and that extraction.
Well, and speaking of local, this was really exciting, what the food farm we had today, and there's a lot of talk about the role that community-based foods can help, the role it can play in revitalizing communities. I mean, do you see a role in kind of specifically addressing some of these issues with the negative impacts of the big ag and that type of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and there are a lot of really great efforts to focus on local food. And I think part of that, too, from a cultural anthropology perspective, is some of this knowledge about the different kinds of things that you can do with food, right? Mm-hmm. Americans are like, I don't know what to do with chicken except chicken breasts. But some of my neighbors use the whole chicken. Right? From the very beak to the claw, right? And if we can have more of that attitude and change some of our expectations around food and how we're supposed to get it and what we're supposed to do with it, right? Like, another thing that I think about is, like, middle-class white Americans eat way more red meat than probably is healthy for us. And that is sort of plays out in our industrial production. If we can have a more diverse diet, we will be healthier. We'll be able to focus on some of these local foods. Like, mm-hmm. maybe we should eat some more rabbit and some more river fish and some more vegetables even. Gosh. Yeah. And different kinds of vegetables, right? Like, it doesn't have to just be carrots, right? One of the things I learned from a potluck when I taught English as a second language in Iowa with Chin Burmese refugees was that I never knew that okra could be eaten raw or cooked. I had only ever eaten it cooked in a stew, like New Orleans style, right? It turns out that they eat raw okra as well. And I was like, gosh, this is delicious. Yeah. But I never would have known that if I hadn't come into contact with my immigrant neighbors from the Burmese ethnic groups who taught me how to eat this vegetable in a new way. Yeah. And so I think things like community gardens that welcome and support immigrant efforts to also do local food, as well as the ones that are maybe sort of engaged in by people with more resources and more privilege for whom it's easier. I think bringing like a community guard that brings those people and all those different kinds of knowledges together is a fantastic effort for the community. And in Columbus Junction, they have a community garden that I think is, again, just a really nice effort in the right direction.
Going back a little bit to the negative impacts, I was struck at how much the issue of wealth disparity in rural communities came up. I saw an interesting study a few years ago where, particularly in places like Iowa, it was known for not having wealth disparity, and it's become a big issue. And it was, people had some pretty heartbreaking stories today, and I'm just seeing the statistics too. It's becoming, they say it's some of the wealth disparity is comparable to what you'd see on Wall Street compared to, you know, some slums or something like that in the old days, that kind of thing. Is that something that you've noticed or that you've studied a little bit?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We definitely see that play out in rural communities. And again, right, it's all about resource extraction. And like when you think about who has the funds or the capital to be able to restore century-old houses in a rural community, certainly it's not immigrant laborers who, you know, are supporting entire networks of their family across multiple nations, right? There are very heartbreaking stories. I also see it as a professor, right? College education has become, you know, in some ways it's become more accessible to working class youth, but also it's the debt load is extraordinary. And I experienced that myself. I think, you know, if I was going to college today, it's a little bit doubtful whether I would think that was available to me, really, like affordable financially. And Morris is very affordable as a college education space. And I love that about working here. But overall, it's heartbreaking the amount of debt that some students are accruing in order to just get the bare minimum of a college education. And I think, again, right, when we think about investments in rural communities, if we think about education, both K-12 and college level, and that includes like community colleges and technical schools, if we think about those as community goods and something that's good for society and support it as such, rather than looking at it as a business that should turn a profit in some way or even support itself, I think we really need to challenge our mindset on that and think about it as a public good.
I can see why people in West Central Minnesota or rural communities or Southwest Iowa or Central Iowa or wherever would care about these issues who are living in rural communities. Why should somebody who lives in the Twin Cities or Chicago or whatever care about the impact of big ag on these communities?
Oh, that's such a great question. And the easy, glib answer is that because everyone eats food, right? And food comes from all these spaces. Food comes from rural communities, it comes from urban spaces, and it can and should come from all of those spaces. And we are all part of a greater community, right? We all are humans who ideally want the best for one another. And so I want urban folks to also have access to healthy, good food and local food, right? And I also think in the 21st century, that means something very different maybe than it did even 20 years ago, right? I am not the kind of proponent for local food that is willing to give up eating strawberries in the winter because I live in Morris, Minnesota. I really like my strawberries with my yogurt.
I really like coffee.
Right. And so I think when we think about local food in the globalized 21st century, we also have to be a little bit realistic about what we want and how we want it to work. And I think we can have a more just, more local, more sustainable, more healthy food system and still enjoy the benefits of technology in the 21st century. But I think right now we're not doing that. We aren't doing it intentionally or in a way that promotes social justice or health in any way.
This is a pretty downer topic. You seem to have hope. You seem to do have hope and see some opportunity here, maybe?
I try. I really try. It is sometimes very much sort of very downer, depressing kind of, you know, against Goliath kind of situation. But I really do look to some of these traditional models of indigenous communities and the histories of labor activism in particular in the Midwest, right? Mexican women arguing for the right to be a factory worker and make the same wage as their male colleagues, right? All of these are very local, very sort of efforts that are steeped in solidarity and care for one another. And I really am inspired by those kinds of histories and activities and by local events like the Food Forum today, right? Like a bunch of people who really care about food and each other and rural community. And that does really give me a lot of hope, particularly on the darker days when it just feels like they're all is lost. Yeah. And, you know, for me, part of that hope is also teaching and helping students see opportunities and possibilities that they maybe hadn't even literally considered or thought of before. And for me, that's also not just students, but in conversations with community members. Like, I had to have somebody say, for example, well, why does a factory have to exist, right? Are you really feeding the world or are you just feeding a bunch of cattle, right? And what does that mean? How you answer that question. And I appreciate those challenges that make us think slightly differently and imagine other possibilities. And that really, imagining those other possibilities is really what gives me hope.
For more on LSP's community-based food systems work and resources related to creating a food and farming system that works for everyone, no matter who they are, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 368 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendell, a Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.